My name is Brooke Balai. I'm with the Centers for Disease Control and the Division of Nutrition, Prescriptive and Obesity. The title of this panel is Opportunities for Prevention from Pregnancy Through Early Life. What is the rationale for this panel? Well, early on during the planning sessions, several people had expressed the idea that there were many moments in an individual's life where little bits of prevention and efforts at health and well-being could have a lot of impact and be very efficacious. So for this panel, we wanted to focus on that idea and bring some of those opportunities to focus throughout the life course. So in other words, just arbitrarily picking a time point, we could look at a young adolescent or adult, a female who's about to become pregnant or soon to become pregnant. What opportunities are there to promote healthy lifestyles during that stage, during pregnancy, and even after pregnancy? Concurrent with that point in time, how can we better promote health and well-being in the young infant, and then of course following that through in the young child, 2 to 5 years of age, who is starting to spend more and more time outside of the home in daycare and in school. So with that broad background, I would like to briefly present our panelists. One of our panelists couldn't be with us today, Joan Ware, who's had 30 years of experience in heart disease and stroke prevention and obesity in the public health field, previously at the Utah Department of Health, and is currently a consultant to the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors. She's given me some ideas to put forth today, and I'll try and incorporate them during the question and answer session. We have Dr. Michael Liu of the University of California, Los Angeles. He's an obstetrician and gynecologist. He's also a public health expert. He has dual appointments at UCLA at the School of Medicine and at the School of Public Health. He's a widely recognized instructor, teacher, care deliverer, researcher, and he's also served on the Institute of Medicine in two capacities, most recently on its committee to re-examine weight gain standards during pregnancy. Excuse me. We have next to Dr. Liu, Dr. Wanda Nicholson at Johns Hopkins University and Institutes. She's also a board-certified obstetrician gynecologist, widely respected, once again, clinician, instructor, and researcher. Her recent research interests have focused on sort of identifying the best times and the best means of implementing postpartum weight gain and control. We have Dr. Diane Ward, who's a professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina. She's also the co-director of the doctoral program in nutrition there. She's had many accomplishments, but today she'll be talking to us briefly about the NAPSAC initiative. For those of us who don't know it, it's the Nutrition and Physical Activity Self-Assessment for Child Care Initiative, and some lessons learned from that process that we can put forward and think about in improving our health delivery and health care. And finally, we have Professor Larry Grumman-Strong, who's a captain in the Uniform Health Services at CDC. He's the chief of the branch of nutrition in the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity. Many of you might know him for many of his different accomplishments, including his work with the Maternal Practices in Infant and Nutrition Care, also called MPINC. But today he'll actually be speaking to us about some preschool information. So with that said, I'll pass the mic on to Dr. Liu. And just a little housekeeping, when we open up for question and answer, please speak into the microphone. The questions and answers are going to be recorded, and so we'd like to save them. And if you're remiss in that, we'll try and repeat the questions out loud. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm delighted to be here and very thankful for this opportunity to come and talk to you all this afternoon. And I have to say that I don't get a whole lot of opportunities like this to talk with you all, and that's really because pregnancy is often left out of the conversation in meetings about obesity prevention. And that's why I'm thankful to organizers of this conference, especially to Dr. Blaine, for putting pregnancy on the program. And that's really because I believe that pregnancy is one of the most important windows of opportunities for primary prevention of obesity. I think that's true for the mother as if it's true for the baby. Now, for the mother, we know that too many women gain too much weight during pregnancy, and the more weight you gain, the more weight you retain. And we know that's true. Either we're talking about more than 10 pounds or 20 pounds postpartum weight retention, either we're talking about white women, black women, or Hispanic women, or whether we're talking about underweight women, normal weight women, overweight women, and obese women. The more weight you gain, the more weight you retain, especially for overweight and obese women. So pregnancy weight gain may be an important driver for the epidemic of overweight and obesity among women of childbearing ages here in the United States. Now, for the child, we know that there's a growing body of research on fetal origins of child obesity. And a few years ago, my students and I did the systematic review of the literature searching for prenatal factors that's been linked to childhood obesity, and we found at least four. Number one, excessive weight gain during pregnancy. Number two, diabetes during pregnancy. Number three, poor nutrition during pregnancy. And number four, smoking during pregnancy. In fact, if your mom smoked during pregnancy, you have about a twofold increased risk for being overweight or obese as a teenager, controlling for a whole bunch of confounding factors. And we're beginning to map out the biological mechanisms underlying these epidemiological associations. So let's take the example of diabetes during pregnancy. Say the mother had diabetes, especially if her diabetes is poorly controlled. We know that there's all that excess glucose which can cross the placenta and cause the baby to produce a lot of insulin. And all that excess insulin during critical periods of development basically does three things. Number one, it lays down a lot of fat cells. Number two, it causes a programmed insulin resistance. And number three, it causes a programmed leptin resistance. Now, y'all know about insulin resistance, but what does leptin resistance do? What's leptin? It's basically a satiety hormone, right? It tells you to stop eating when you're full. So if you get leptin resistance in the brain, what are you going to do? You're going to keep on eating. Leptin also tells your pancreas to stop producing insulin. So if you get leptin resistance in the pancreas, you can keep on producing insulin, which is going to lay down more fat. So by the time that baby is born, she's already born predisposed to a lifelong struggle with overweight and obesity and early onset type 2 diabetes because of all that excess fat cells and programmed insulin resistance and leptin resistance. And then you add on top of that the fast food nation that supersizes everything, and that may be what's partly driving this whole epidemic of childhood overweight and obesity and early onset type 2 diabetes that we're seeing in this country. Okay? So if we want to prevent childhood obesity in this country, what do we have to do? It's probably not enough to just talk about school lunches or physical activities, right? Not that those aren't important, but by the time that baby's born, you lost half of the battle already. So if we really want to do something about preventing childhood obesity, we've got to start much earlier than that by making sure that mom has good nutrition during pregnancy, that she gains appropriate weight gain during pregnancy, that she quits smoking during pregnancy, or better yet, before pregnancy, or doesn't pick up smoking in the first place, and that her diabetes is in good control. I think what's really fascinating about this whole business of fetal programming is this phenomenon called epigenetics. Okay? What's really about volume control for genes? Okay? You can turn up or down, you can switch on or off your gene expression, based on your environmental exposures, especially those exposures during critical periods of development. Okay? And you can do that simply by putting a chemical tag. Okay? In this case, this is a methyl group, one carbon, three hydrogen atoms. You put it directly in front of that gene, and that blocks that gene from ever being expressed. Okay? Alternatively, if you were to remove that methyl group, that allows that gene to freely express itself. So generally speaking, methylation turns off, blocks, silences gene expression, whereas demethylation turns on, turns up gene expression. Okay. And let me just illustrate the example, the importance of the idea of epigenetics with this example here. What do you see on this slide? Mice, right? You see some blonde and chubby mice, and you see some brown and slim mice. Would you believe that these mice are actually genetically identical? See, these mice actually all carry the same agouti gene, okay, which turns their fur coat blonde. The same gene also causes them to overeat, which confer a high risk for obesity, diabetes, and even cancer later on in life. But despite being genetically identical, researchers in the study were able to turn some of these mice from blonde and chubby to brown and slim simply by feeding their mothers a diet rich in folic acid during pregnancy. Okay. Now, what does folic acid have anything to do with this? Well, it turns out that folic acid is a very rich methyl donor, and moms who ate a diet rich in folic acid basically methylated, silenced, turned off, blocked that obesity gene that would cause the baby to overeat later on in life. Now imagine that, someday being able to tell our patient that we know how to turn on those genes that confer good health and longevity and turn off those genes that would confer a high risk for obesity, diabetes, and cancer later on in life. Okay. We're certainly nowhere close to that today, but that's because, and we shouldn't infer too much dietary advice from a study on rats, because not all humans are rats, but I think this is one of the earliest and best examples of how early nutrition could influence DNA methylation, and that how such epigenetic changes could have lifelong impact on health and function. So my 5 minutes are up, and so I'm going to, but I was asked to just say a word about breastfeeding, which I think is very, very important, and I'm going to make 2 points about this. Number one is that there is a growing body of research that suggests that breastfeeding protects against obesity later in life. And number two, we do know that provider encouragement during pregnancy actually has a significant impact on breastfeeding initiation. And here it underscores, again, one of my most important take-home points from today is that pregnancy is a very important, critical windows of opportunity for primary prevention of both maternal and child obesity. Thank you very much.
I'd just like to also extend my thank you for being invited to speak today. In my 5 minutes, I have 3 primary points. One is to try to emphasize why I think that the postpartum period is such a critical period in the primary prevention of chronic disease in women. Two, to quickly summarize, very briefly summarize, where we are in terms of postpartum interventions for weight control. And then to try to suggest some potential next steps that we might take to better integrate interventions into the current health system model. So postpartum weight retention. We define postpartum weight retention as the difference between your weight at some point after delivery and what your weight was at the beginning of pregnancy or just prior to conception. And we know from a recent report from the Institute of Medicine guidelines that women in general can retain about 40% of the weight that they gain in pregnancy. In fact, about a quarter of women will still be 10 pounds heavier, or would have retained 10 pounds, I'm sorry, by 1 year postpartum. What's particularly alarming about postpartum weight retention is the distribution of the weight. And we know that it tends to accumulate centrally. And because of that, we know that women who retain their weight are therefore at increased risk of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and also the development of gestational diabetes or diabetes of pregnancy with any subsequent pregnancies. Across all sort of racial, ethnic groups, socioeconomic levels, we know that there are several logistical barriers that women encounter to losing the weight that they gain in pregnancy. Family commitments, basic cooking and cleaning, family get-togethers, a sick infant. All of these are barriers, in addition to their work and out-of-the-home commitments, that can prevent them from achieving the weight loss that they desire. And when we look at racial and ethnic disparities, and I know this is being covered in one of the other concurrent sessions, we also see racial and ethnic differences in weight retention. In a recent study from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, or Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute funded study, the CARDIA study, black women, in fact, tended to retain about twice as much weight compared to white women. I'm not going to go through this slide. I actually put it up here to remind us of where we are when it comes to the development and integration of postpartum weight loss intervention. In 2005, the United States Preventive Services Task Force put out a guideline that suggested that we integrate behavior weight loss interventions into primary care. But there's not any mention of pregnancy or the postpartum period in those guidelines. And that's primarily because we don't have a substantial amount of evidence-based interventions in this population. These are studies, or the first five are studies that were published in a Cochrane review in 2006. And in each of these first five studies, there was weight loss in women who were exposed to a lifestyle intervention that consisted of diet and exercise. However, the populations were fairly homogeneous and were fairly catered toward higher socioeconomic women. So again, we still have a long way to go, a substantial amount of work to do to develop the interventions that can be adapted for all populations of women in the postpartum period. Listed here are three studies that I recently retrieved from clinicaltrials.gov, and so they are ongoing studies, or either ones that have recently been completed, that are attempting to test postpartum weight loss intervention. One is by a colleague, Dr. Osby, actually at Duke, is funded by NIDDK, that's looking at a population of 450 women and looking at a 12-month intervention. Dr. Ferrara is actually out in Kaiser Permanente in Oakland, California, and she's looking at women who have already been diagnosed with diabetes in pregnancy and looking at weight loss interventions in that population. And then at Hopkins, we just completed a pilot study where we looked at a small population, 30 women, and adapted an intervention for up to 6 months postpartum, again looking at weight loss at the end of that 6 months. So again, when we look at what is currently existing in the literature in terms of published interventions and then what's ongoing, again, the postpartum period and I think pregnancy and childbearing women in general, this is the area from a public health perspective that needs more of our attention. So what can we do? What are some next strategies? These are some strategies that I've thought about and very interested in discussing with you all as the audience today. From a clinical perspective, I'm a clinician, so when I think about what can I do when I go into each of those exams room in my office practice? Well, one, perhaps we can integrate assessment and counseling for obesity or integrate that training better into our workforce. I can speak for myself when I say that when I finished my OBGYN residency, we did not get specific training in obesity prevention and how to counsel women. And so I think when we look across the workforce, whether it's OBGYN, internal medicine, pediatrics, this is the area that needs our attention. Two, do we need to look at quality measures for the diagnosis and multidisciplinary management of overweight and obesity? Can't be done by one group. Has to be a multi-task approach. And finally, do we look at developing and issuing some policies where we actually refer specific childbearing women who we know are at risk for developing chronic disease in the long term? And then finally, and I think perhaps more importantly, how do we then transition clinical strategies into public health strategies for the broader community? One, we need to look at how do we integrate behavioral interventions, such as the ones I've mentioned, into postpartum care for high-risk groups. The general postpartum period in terms of clinical evaluation ends at 6 weeks, and most moms are back to work, back to their usual tasks. So how do we focus on women with higher BMIs, women with GDM or gestational diabetes, or specific high-risk groups such as urban-based women or women in rural areas? How do we better integrate behavioral interventions into their postpartum period? Perhaps this is a time where we can extend, and this really should say develop, a patient-centered medical home, which is a concept that is being discussed quite substantially these days. Perhaps we need to extend and have a patient-centered medical home for the postpartum woman. Perhaps we could work with additional funding to do some demonstration projects to look at the efficacy of the medical home and try to figure out how we can evaluate or develop some models of seamless transition so that we are transitioning women from perinatal and postpartum care back into primary care. And I think that's important whether we're looking at lower income or Medicaid eligible women or whether we're looking at women who are commercially insured. Just to close, I wanted to just show a few pictures from our photo album from the intervention study, our pilot intervention that we conducted, because I think it again emphasizes as we go forward what a special group the postpartum woman is. She's a wife, she's a mother, she's a sister, she's an employee, she may be an employer, and so she has a multifaceted busy lifestyle. So if you look to the left, she's a mother. Here's a cooking demonstration. She has to cook not only for herself but for her family. Usually wherever she goes, she's involved with childcare. So again, postpartum interventions will have to be developed in a way that it accommodates the mother and the child. And at the bottom, some offspring of our graduates of our recent postpartum intervention. Thank you.
I also wanted to join my colleagues in thanking you for the opportunity to be here today and to share some of the lessons that we have learned from our work with the KNAPSAC program. What I want to do during my 5 minutes is to really introduce you, if you haven't aren't familiar with it, to the KNAPSAC program itself, to report on some of the findings that we learned when we were involved in the implementation of that program, and three, to make some recommendations based on those findings that we might want to suggest as a way of implementing more healthy weight development strategies in the childcare setting. Listening to the first two speakers and thinking chronologically, you would think that the next speaker really should talk about birth, to the age of two or three. So there's a little bit of gap, and I'm going to skip that gap because I'm going to talk about children between the ages of two and five. To give you just a little bit of background, just really two things I wanted to say before we get into my remarks, is one is that there has been about a 300% increase in the number of overweight and obese children between the ages of two and five. And second, many children receive care in an out-of-home setting, and of these children, a large proportion are enrolled in organized child care. So hence the work. Because of those, the need and the opportunity, we developed the KNAPSAC program. And as Brooke said, KNAPSAC stands for Nutrition and Physical Activity Self-Assessment for Child Care. And the name really relates to sort of the fundamental step in the program, which is starting with a provider self-assessment. So that's what the name is. And we developed this initiative with input from a number of stakeholders, child care providers, public health officials, and support from the Division of Public Health in North Carolina, the Centers for Disease Control, our North Carolina Prevention Partners, and as well as the Prevention Center at the University of North Carolina and the Department of Nutrition. The first step in the development of the KNAPSAC intervention was to take a careful assessment of recommendations, national recommendations, as well about nutrition and physical activity that would be appropriate for the development of healthy weight in childcare settings. So we looked at all these national standards and recommendations and extracted those that were appropriate for nutrition and physical activity. Added to that was a review of the research evidence about the association between nutrition and physical activity, environments and policies, and the development of healthy weight. And third, that we involved a lot of experts, both state level as well as national experts, in the area of nutrition and physical activity. We implemented the program in 96 child care centers in 33 counties across the state of North Carolina. We saw a significant change in the nutrition area, and not quite as much in terms of the physical activity area. And I may have moved through this quickly. The NAPSAC program is an intervention that addresses nutrition and physical activity, environment and policy. So that's what the change is trying to change the environment and policy at child care settings. All right, what did we find in our experiences with implementing the NAPSAC program? Well, we found some good. Virtually all the juice that is served in those sample of those centers is 100% fruit juice. Most of the centers do follow CACFP guidelines. Most centers serve fruit every day, and regular playtime is provided daily in most centers. But there's also the bad. Whole milk is the predominant form of milk that's served in centers. 100% juice is served in place of fruit. Few centers serve meals family style. The activity levels of children in these centers is low, and physical activity education for staff is rarely provided. But there was also the ugly. Most of these centers serve a majority of high-fat or fried meats. They serve prepackaged processed foods for snacks. And if there's a TV present, children watch it. So if there's a TV in the classroom, it is used for non-educational purposes. So some recommendations. We feel like that these or other best practice guidelines for nutrition and physical activity should be adopted for child care programs. We think that the CACFP food standard should be consistent with the dietary guidelines. I think we need to bring it up to the dietary guidelines. We need to use the child care setting to reach out to parents and to families for the promotion of healthy weight. We need to create some consistent standards among nutrition programs that serve 0 to 5-year-olds. But these centers also need tangible support to make change in order to enhance the healthy weight environments. I thought you might be interested, those of you that aren't from California and maybe haven't seen these, that these are 4 recommendations that were recently came out of the Child Care Nutrition Environment Advisory Group. And they suggested strengthening the child and adult food care program, establishing nutrition and physical activity requirements for child care, provide consistent messaging related to nutrition and physical activity, and expand training for nutrition and physical activity in child care programs. If you're interested in more information about the NAPSAC program, you could consult the Center of Excellence for Training and Research Translation at the University of North Carolina, sponsored by the Centers for Disease Control, or contact the NAPSAC office. We'll be happy to provide all the information there. Thank you.
All right, well, good afternoon. I'd like to share with you some results that we just published last Friday on the Pediatric Nutrition Surveillance System. These are results of what's going on in trends and geographic patterns of pediatric obesity related to 2 to 4-year-olds. I want to just start off with a little bit of why are we interested in preschool children. A lot of this conference has focused on adult obesity, it's focused on childhood obesity, but oftentimes in the context of school-aged children. And I think one of the key messages of this panel is we really need to be thinking much earlier. Even during pregnancy, I'm trying to kind of get our thinking to move earlier. I didn't think that I was going to be the latest one in the entire panel as we think about pregnancy through the first 5 years of life. But why this age group? We do know that obesity that starts out in these young children continues to be obesity in adolescence and adulthood. The risk factors are already set up there to have these children at higher risk of obesity later on in life. And we know that they're at increased risk of many of the consequences of obesity. Higher risk of diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, asthma, sleep apnea, all of those health conditions that we're concerned about with adult obesity, those risk factors are already set up in these very young children. So we're very concerned about this age group. Treatment is very difficult in adults. This is a large theme of this conference, is we really have to be thinking about prevention. And we can't just be thinking about prevention once we have adolescents who are becoming obese. We have to be thinking much earlier in the life cycle. And so prevention really is critical. And yet, many of the interventions that we think about for adults also have their impact on our young children. When we talk about the safety, walkability, and access of our communities, that includes access to parks and recreation. If the parents are able to walk to the grocery store to get their groceries, they're going to be bringing their children along as well, and those children are going to be getting that walking going on from a very young age. So many of the interventions that we need to be having to redesign our communities will have an impact across the entire lifespan. Putting in place access to healthier food through farmers markets, through corner stores that have available fruits and vegetables in them, working in community gardens, getting our children out involved in them, all of these are activities that are going to affect the diets of our young children as well as they are throughout the lifespan. So it's not that we have to think about a different intervention necessarily. Many of the community interventions will have an impact on this age group, but we can't forget about what needs to be done for them. We also have to think about what are the interventions that are specific to that age group so that we make sure we're doing the prevention early on. And some of the stuff that was just shared about the childcare standards for physical activity and the nutritional quality of food provided in our daycare centers is absolutely critical that we be thinking there. We also have some interventions that are specifically oriented to that age group, with interventions going right to 2 to 5 year old children. And because the data that I'm going to be presenting largely come from the WIC program across the country, I want to share some of the interventions that have been done in the WIC program. The FitWIC program for childhood overweight prevention has demonstrated a number of changes in behaviors. They've integrated physical activity interventions into the WIC program that really is a nutrition program, but they've involved physical activity into that. They've demonstrated through some of the interventions that they're able to change parenting skills through WIC. There are demonstrations of staff behaviors being quite different in these FitWIC programs. There have been initiatives within WIC to address many of the underlying risk factors that lead to obesity. A lot of initiatives on breastfeeding, and we've seen tremendous success in increasing breastfeeding rates within the WIC program. There's been a dramatic shift toward use of fat-free milk and low-fat milk instead of whole-fat milk within the WIC program. And we've seen successful interventions to reduce television viewing in that population. Haven't seen the effects yet, but this year WIC is rolling out a completely new food package that is largely oriented to addressing the childhood obesity epidemic. And so the fruit and vegetable voucher is now going to be given to give families access to fruits and vegetables as a voucher that for this age group, 2 to 5 year olds, is going to be $8 a month. It's only going to allow them to have a voucher for low-fat and skim milk. And it reduces the quantity of food in the food package that is in the form of juice or milk or cheese or eggs that tend to be those higher fat or liquid calories. And so we're going to be seeing a shift in the distribution of the kinds of foods going out to these children. So what do we see right now? As I said, we were sharing some new results on trends. And this is a long-term picture of what has happened in essentially the WIC program. We also have some other low-income data, but this is primarily WIC that we're looking at here. Since 1989, we were seeing continuous year-by-year increases in the prevalence of pediatric overweight. Something happened in 2003 that all of these community interventions, the impact of FitWIC, somehow seems to have made a difference. Because as of 2003, we've not seen any continuous increases in pediatric overweight. This is good news for us. We hope that it's a bellwether of what we might be seeing down the road for older age children, that we can actually slow down that increase and eventually turn down the increases in pediatric overweight. However, we continue to see huge disparities in the prevalence of overweight across all of these time periods. In Hispanics, we continue to see high rates of pediatric obesity getting close to 20%. American Indians continue to have high rates, and they have not seen that slowdown or stabilization of the trend in pediatric obesity. It is continuing to rise among Native American Alaska Indian populations. So we're very concerned about interventions being placed there. And I wanted to share with you a map that we have on our website now of how these rates compare geographically from county to county of what their pediatric obesity rates are. And you see here some interesting patterns with very high rates of obesity along the Pacific coast, rates in southern Texas and southern Florida, through the Appalachian states. On the other hand, very low rates in some of the counties in Colorado and Nevada. We don't know exactly what the communities are doing in those places, but we think that there are lessons to be learned from those places that are having greater success with pediatric obesity, where they're keeping their rates below 5%, other places seeing rates above 20%. So to summarize, this obesity epidemic does seem to have plateaued, at least among low-income preschool children. We think this may be the result of community interventions and some of the specific interventions in WIC, but the rates continue to be much higher than they ought to be, and we're very concerned about the continued high rates of pediatric obesity, especially among Hispanics, and the continuing rise among American Indians. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the panel. In the interest of time, I was going to recommend, if it's okay with everyone, that we forego the moderator questions and just proceed directly to the floor. So please go ahead.
Thank you for covering so much in such a short amount of time. There was two areas that I felt really should have been covered or I'd like you to at least address. And one is looking a little bit more upstream at preconception and what can be done to reduce ethnic disparity and obesity in the preconception period. And the second question is, as I understand, if a baby is born underweight or low weight or low birth weight, that they're also at increased risk, especially if they have rapid weight gain in those first couple years. And is that true? And if so, what is the recommendation to do for these low birth weight babies to prevent later obesity?
Maybe I'll take the first question. I'm so glad you brought this up because when we're talking about pregnancy to early childhood, I think that we still didn't start early enough as a panel, and that we really need to be talking about preconception. If a woman enters pregnancy with the biology and behavior that puts her and her baby at risk, I think it's very hard for us to change that overnight during prenatal care. And so I think certainly starting with preconception care would be very important. The problem is, as you know, a lot of women, especially low-income women, have very limited access to healthcare in this country when they are not pregnant. And so one of the things that we really need to push for in the context of pushing for universal health insurance is to make sure that, that women have universal access to preconception care and, in fact, making sure that they have access to healthcare before, during, between pregnancies and indeed across their entire lifespan.
I just wanted to add one, I agree with everything that Michael said, but I wanted to add, again, one more plug for postpartum, which, again, can run into the preconception period for the next pregnancy. True, you've missed that initial opportunity in the current pregnancy, but you still have time to make a big difference for the second or third child. And adding to that, in addition to expanding coverage for preconception care, is the whole issue that normally coverage, particularly in low-income women, will end at 6 to 8 weeks. And we know that most interventions are more efficacious if they're up to 1 year in length. And, you know, in addressing coverage, how do we also extend that postpartum coverage, particularly for minority and low-income women, to address weight loss and lifestyle behavior changes?
If I can add on this issue of preconception care, I think we really have to start thinking about a complete life cycle approach to this. When we talk about preconception care, it's wonderful to think about it in terms of that intended pregnancy and what do I need to do before I become pregnant, but we know that many pregnancies are not intended, and we know that many women don't have access to care. And so what we really have to be thinking about is all women of reproductive age and how do we address the risk factors that they have throughout that. And then at that, when we start thinking that broadly, it becomes now, so are we moving back around the circle or are we following the circle around the other end? And it really is a full circle, and we have to think about the whole population. I think the other reason that we have to be thinking whole populations here is that we know from an intervention perspective, when you try to intervene on young children, if you're not addressing the entire family, they're going to fail. And so we have to be thinking about that entire cycle.
My name's Kathy Christoffel. I'm a pediatrician in Chicago, and I kind of wear two hats in my obesity-related work. I see overweight children, ages 2 to 11, more or less, and have been doing that for many decades. I also am involved with the CLOCK Network, Consortium to Lower Obesity in Chicago Children, which is focused on environmental and community changes. And I'm going to comment on this question here first and then ask my question to you. From your point about the attributes of the infant are exactly right, and this panel has been addressing mostly maternal risk factors and then the risk factors that the children carry into the preschool years. But we know that there are risk factors that the children have at birth. So there are maternal risk factors, and then there are child risk factors which become evident before birth and perinatally. Underweight, overweight are both risk factors, and we know that the rapid weight gain in the first 6 months and 12 months and 24 months, all of those intervals, contribute to it. So the interaction of maternal risk factor, child risk factor, and rapid weight gain in early childhood is a recipe for disaster. So those of us who interact with any of those players, maternal, infant, et cetera, have to be alert to all of those factors and intervene as best we can. I don't think we know the best recipe for doing it yet. So that's my comment. My question is, I felt like the first two of you spoke to my clinician self, and the second two of you spoke to my public health self, and that you weren't talking to each other. And I'm impressed at the agenda of dealing with weight gain during pregnancy and postpartum weight gain, but how can you do it without linking those mothers up with WIC? And how can you help the reduce postpartum weight gain if you're not giving them information through preschool settings? So I think we have to set up a conversation between these two parts of the dais, and when we do, both halves will be more effective. So I'm interested in your reactions to that, since you all spoke from within your discipline.
And I think one of the issues that I did get into was then, where and how do you deliver it? You know, perhaps it's not best in obstetrics. Perhaps it's not best in the postpartum visit. Perhaps it's at WIC when they present at WIC. Perhaps it's at the child care vaccination appointment, which certainly at that juncture you can affect the mother, the child, and hopefully the rest of the family. So part of it, I think, probably was a time frame. But I agree that it has to be a multidisciplinary agenda or initiative.
I'll just comment kind of, you know, besides just the usual hat that I wear, also some of the thinking that went in. What we were really trying to do was figure out what might explain this stabilization. And I have to be honest, I don't know that I've seen enough change in the way clinical practice is dealing with pediatric obesity to give me the feeling that there has been a real change in that in the last 5 years that would explain this slower increase or the plateauing. That being said, we have to look to multiple sectors to try to address this, and absolutely need to be bringing the clinical side as well as the community health side and the daycare side to move all of these agendas forward if we're going to see a downturn. If I can come back to Suzanne's question about the birth weight and the rapid weight gain, I think we have to think about how do we intervene on those. And Dr. Liu did talk about some of the pregnancy issues that are there to get to a healthy birth weight. And there are so many reasons that we need to have babies born at a healthy birth weight. It's more difficult to think about what do we do about rapid weight gain in infancy.
It's hard to say, you know, you don't want to be restricting calories. How exactly do you get those interventions is complicated. You're not going to get a whole lot of physical activity in those young babies. Really, the intervention we have to be thinking about is breastfeeding. Dr. Liu mentioned that. But we know the breastfed babies do not put on weight as rapidly. The World Health Organization growth charts demonstrate that for us. That's the intervention that we really need to be thinking about to address that issue of the rapid weight gain during infancy.
I just want to highlight a point that was in one of Dr. Nicholson's slides and touches on what Larry just mentioned. The idea that we can somehow mobilize the medical care setting to improve the way they deliver counseling and physical activity and nutritional advice to their patients. The question of quality improvement measures comes up, and whether that be from NCQA or be governed by another regulatory agency, the Board of Pediatrics, for example, in conjunction with the Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology, I think is probably a very important avenue to explore and foster if we can. Next question, please. Thank you.
Okay. So my question refers to that time between 0 and 2 years of age. My name is Sarah, and I work with the Michigan Department of Community Health in a CDC-funded program to prevent obesity. And I am excited to be working with the State Breastfeeding Coalition on a grant that was provided by HRSA. And this is to train public health professionals to work with work sites to provide lactation support to mothers. And so this actually relates to the child care setting. I know child care for ages 0 to 2 wasn't really addressed, and part of my question is how many of those birth to 2 kids are in daycare, so how much reach would it have if you were to have an intervention like this? But I don't believe KnapSack addresses milk handling practices, and so if we're working with mothers and they can pump in the workplace, if they can't bring it to the daycare and get someone to feed it to the baby, I see that as being kind of a fault in the system that we're trying to create if we can't get it to the baby. So can you comment on if you had already thought of that or what value you think that might have?
Yeah, that's really a great question and a comment. Just to be clear, the KnapSack program was designed, it was for the 2 to 5 year old, and that was our objective because we worked with our state obesity program, and that's what they wanted us to do. Now, we haven't really gotten the funding that we needed to really do the expansions, but in association with Nemours, we have been done some initial work on the 0 to 2, we call it baby nap, model, which addresses some of the particular issues that relate to the infant who is being enrolled in some type of out-of-home care. I can't give you the exact statistics, but there's plenty of reach. There's definitely plenty of reach, and I've often thought that a wonderful opportunity, missed opportunity for intervention is that working low-income mom who's going back at the minimal point, 6 weeks, which some children are enrolled at 6 weeks, struggling to maintain breastfeeding. And what a good opportunity, because they're now giving over care to some hopefully well-trained provider, at the same time trying to confront the issues about maintaining breastfeeding. I think this is an area that needs a lot more work. I can't say we've done it through our KnapSack work, but only because, not for lack of interest, but for lack of a resource opportunity. So I would encourage those of you that have access to that. We've given, we've got a plan that one could follow on how to take that 0 to 2 work. We've done some initial work. I think it has to do with both physical activity of this age group as well as the nutrition and the transition in feeding that comes during that period.
My question is specifically on the Institute of Medicine guidelines, the weight gain during pregnancy for Dr. Liu. thinking broadly now of a new health system that we're building in this country, what kinds of changes would have to be instituted or added to our health system so that America could realize that vision that the Institute of Medicine has for weight gain during pregnancy? Because currently, women do not gain at that rate.
Right. So I think that we really need to have both a clinical approach as well as a public health approach. I think the clinical approach, we really need to make sure that we're doing better in terms of nutritional counseling during pregnancy. Right now, we do a very poor job at that, and I think every pregnant woman in the United States should have access to nutritional counseling, and that such counseling should be covered by both public as well as private insurance. I also think that it's often too late by the time they come in for prenatal care, and therefore kind of emphasizing the importance of health care access before pregnancy and between pregnancies. I think that's all important to do. But I also think that more importantly, we need to think about the conditions that are creating this obesity epidemic in our society, for which the gestational weight gain is a symptom. Right in Los Angeles, we have a lot of communities. We have many communities where there are more fast food restaurants than healthy restaurants, and more liquor stores than there are grocery stores. The quality of foods are a lot less in disadvantaged communities. The prices are higher. So I think unless we start addressing those social determinants, the clinical approach by itself is not going to do better in terms of meeting those guidelines.
Thank you. We're pretty much at time, but so one more question and then we'll call it quits.
I'm also a pediatrician, and I work in the primary care practice-based research area, and I'm kind of hitting a little bit similar points to what Dr. Christoffel was referring before, but more on the practical issues. And you know, we're having a generation of the Nintendo parents having kids right now, and they're not very physically prepared. And I was wondering about the knapsack program, if you have done any motor development assessment of those children and motor development programs that prepare children for physical activity, as is expected to that they're going to be moving and going in the future into doing more physical activity. And I was wondering about that. What is your strategy? What is the idea of preparing them from the get-go with motor skill development?
Thank you for the opportunity, Ruth, to respond to that. Our focus has been on trying to establish the best the guidelines, the best practice guidelines for an environment that would support healthy weight, and included in that are guidelines for physical activity. So we have a number of suggestions about, based on evidence, that what should be there, which would include generous opportunities for active play, teacher-led opportunities for motor development, as well as appropriate staff behaviors, good policies, appropriate physical environments that we think will all combine to add to the motor development of children.
Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you to the audience, and thank you, Dr. Kaki, for being so patient with us up there.